Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. And as most of our listeners should know by now, Supreme Court Justice Scalia passed away this past weekend. And we're going to talk about what that means for the current Supreme Court cases and filling his seat.
We're also going to spend a little time nerding out about one of our founding fathers who, and this is fitting, I guess, having it just been President's Day, but who really is at the origins of a lot of the ideas that we currently talk about in the anti-poverty policy world.
It's a fun episode.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross, and we're joined by Ian Milheiser, who is the Justice Editor of Think Progress. I did not say that with much confidence.
No, but you got it right.
But I got it right.
just pronounce it right, spell it, you know, mostly correct if you have to.
Yeah. Thankfully, we don't usually have to spell things on air. We haven't done one of those segments in a while.
Right.
But I'm mostly making fun of Tracy because, Ian, I never get your book title right. So I feel like since I would like to, you know, remind people, yes, that your day job is Justice Editor Think Progress, but you also have a fabulous book. So I don't screw it up. What is the title of that book, Ian?
It is Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Available, by the way, at all major book retailers.
Your publisher will be very happy with you.
Don't walk, run, and get the book now.
But people have already bought it if they're loyal listeners, because they've heard Ian a couple of times. They've heard him talk about this book.
In case anyone new has come along, though, by all means, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Pals, wherever you want to go, it's there.
But the reason we're having you on, Ian, is that the last several days have been big ones for the Supreme Court.
Yeah, shit just got real.
That will be the name of this episode.
Yes.
Shit just got real.
You are referring to the death of Scalia, which...
One of the justices on the high court.
Which I think evoked a lot of mixed emotions from people, but I think for SCOTUS scholars such as yourself, this meant... hit the ground running on analysis and figure out what the hell's going on. So we thought we should bring you back to help us figure out what the hell's going on.
Yeah, well, welcome to the Super Bowl. this is a huge deal. I mean, Scalia was a solid member of the court's conservative bloc. There hasn't been there's really only been 20 years of American history. You should read my book to find out about that, where we've had a liberal Supreme Court. And the last time we had one was 50 years ago. If President Obama gets to replace Scalia, that means that we will have a left of center court for the first time in half a century. This is a really big deal.
This is like Warren Court situation.
I mean, bigger than the Warren Court.
This would be bigger than the Warren Court.
Bear in mind, like, the Warren Court didn't recognize women's rights to equality. Roe v. Wade happened after the Warren Court. I mean, we would have the best Supreme Court in American history if we can fill this
So
seat.
Before we dive into the cases, the key word, though, that you said is if. President Obama is able to appoint another justice or get another justice confirmed, rather. So what is going on? Can you break down for us what's happening in the Senate? Because it looks like conservatives are going to do everything they can to ensure this does not happen.
So, the backdrop here is that Republicans have really ambitious plans for what they wanted to accomplish in the Supreme Court. I mean, shockingly ambitious plans, like denuding the EPA of any ability to do pretty much anything. And probably the Labor Department and a bunch of other agencies like that in the process. Striking down the Affordable Care Act we all know about. Making it so that a woman's boss gets to decide if they have access to birth control. They had stunningly ambitious plans. And all those plans are shot now because it takes five votes and now they've only got four. And so their hope is that they can hold this seat open for as long as it takes for a Republican to be in the White House. And right now their talking point is they want it to be the next president. Don't believe them. If a year from now it's Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, don't expect them to suddenly decide, oh, I love Hillary Clinton so much that I can't wait to get her justice.
You find that implausible?
I find it somewhat implausible that Mitch McConnell is just itching to get Bernie Sanders to put someone on the Supreme Court.
But so, you know, digging into that a little bit further, right? So what is that, how does that compare to past moments in history, right? The talking point we keep hearing in the media is, you know, not in election years, and it's customary to wait for the next president. You and other folks at CAP and at Think Progress have looked into the numbers, and that doesn't seem to be true.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what day this is going to come out, but as I say these words, we are on the anniversary of Justice Anthony Kennedy's confirmation. Justice Kennedy was confirmed in 1988, which was an election year. It was President Reagan's last year in the White House. The Senate, which was a Democratic Senate, confirmed Republican President Anthony Kennedy's nomination. They didn't wait to see how the election plays out so they could maybe get a Democratic appointee in there as well. And that's been the ordinary practice. I mean, the ordinary practice is that if a nominee is completely beyond the pale, so Robert Bork, for example.
I always forget about him.
Oh, Bork,
how
what
could I forget
guy,
about Robert Bork?
Was. Yeah. Bork had said that the Civil Rights Act, the ban on whites-only lunch counters.
We're already giggling. I'm sorry. This is just ridiculous. Keep going.
Yeah, and like the quote from him is like, it's like a self-parody. He says that the Civil Rights Act is rooted in a principle of unsurpassed ugliness. That's his word. So like, if Obama appoints, I don't even know who the left equivalent of, like if he nominates Fidel Castro,
right,
then like the Republicans would be in their right to say, no, we're not going to confirm Fidel Castro to the Supreme Court. But
can we quote you on that?
I think you heard it here first.
Yes,
you heard it here first. Mitch McConnell, you have my permission not to confirm Fidel Castro. But I mean, outside something outlandish, the ordinary practice has been that the nominee, you know, they're put up, you look at their qualifications, you make sure they haven't done something of Borkian craziness. and then they get confirmed. And then that has been the ordinary practice.
And that's the advice and consent process.
Right.
That's what that means.
But as we know, this Senate doesn't necessarily look at ordinary practice.
Ordinary is not what they do.
So I mean, they're going to ignore this. They're going to continue to say their talking points about the American people getting to choose and have a role in this with the election of the next president.
Can I take issue with that, though, just for one second?
Right,
because
I know.
That talking point, it makes me want to bang my head against the television.
Because it's like, oh, did we appoint Obama president?
Right.
Did we not vote for him?
I'm sorry, but presidents come from elections.
Exactly,
the voters pick the president, and the president gets to pick the justice.
So
Obama bought the election with his Obama photo.
Oh, I forgot.
I forgot. You guys didn't get the gifts. I'm the only one in the studio that got my black people gifts.
I didn't get the swag, but Tracy did.
I'll share.
Being white in this country sucks.
but so the fact that they're going to, you know, continue to say their talking points, do you anticipate there being any political ramifications for them? Because I don't know, it seems like, will the average conservative voter really care that they were holding up the process? This seems like, you know, a win for them.
How does this compare to, like, government shutdown?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, it's exactly like the government shutdown. I mean, what has happened? This is a symptom of a much greater disease. What has happened is that Americans' constitutional system depends on there being some degree of consensus. You know, the parties have to get together every now and then and agree, like, okay, we're just going to not, you know, fight over these big philosophical disputes we have, and we're going to continue to fund the government. We're going to raise the debt ceiling. We're going to make sure that the government is operating, and that means that all the seats on the Supreme Court are filled. And what has changed is that the Republican Party, since Barack Obama became president, has decided that they care more about fighting their ideological battles than they care about keeping the wheels of America turning, and that they're willing to shut it all down if they don't get their way. And this is just like the government shutdown. It's just like the debt ceiling crisis. It is a raw, barbaric yelp of power that there are 54 of us and only 46 of them. We have the power to get our way, and it doesn't matter what the norms are. It doesn't matter what this means for the nation. We're just going to do it. I think it's setting a very dangerous precedent. I can get into why this is dangerous in a little bit. But it's the same instinct that brought us the government shutdown that's bringing this refusal.
Imagine you're a conservative strategist. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that will do to your health right now. But, you know, would you say, though, this is smart for them? I'm trying to, you know, understand how they can play this out.
Well, let's get inside their heads. I attend the Federalist Society's conference every year. It's the annual meeting.
Are they aware that you're?
it's weird. Not only are they aware, they feed me.
They invite you.
And Republicans have so much money. The food is good.
So you are getting gifts, just not from Obama.
Yeah, like one year I was there. I was walking down the hall. This random person was like, "Oh, hello. Would you like some bourbon?" They have so much money. They're just giving away whiskey.
Out with the wrong folks, Tracy.
Yeah, seriously. We've made bad career decisions here.
Bad political decisions, apparently.
But when they aren't feeding hostile reporters bourbon, you know, they have very lively panels where they've laid out an extraordinarily aggressive agenda. And it's not just the stuff that makes headlines. I mean, yes, it's about birth control and it's about abortion and it's about, like, their theories of religion and all these things that make headlines. But the number one thing, the thing that they're most obsessed with, is shutting down federal agencies. They want to take away agencies' ability to regulate. So that means that the EPA won't be able to come up with new ways to fight pollution. That means the Labor Department won't be able to protect unions. That is what they are after.
And even though sometimes they can't remember all three agencies they want to shut down, they know there are three.
They do know there are three. And I mean, honestly, like, at least in terms of on the regulatory side, their ambitions are really to shut them all down. They have such ambitious plans for making it impossible for agencies to make new regulations that it would essentially, you know, it would make new regulations virtually impossible. That is what they're –
This is government shutdown on steroids.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so if you're the sort of person who thinks that's a good idea, like if you're the sort of person that thinks that the fact that we're preventing coal plants from putting out clouds of mercury in the air is a crime against liberty. If that's what you believe, then it makes sense to you to say, oh, God, the last thing we need is having someone who believes what Obama thinks on the Supreme Court. Because if you're already that far to the right, anyone in the space of normality looks like a crazy person to you.
Let alone Bernie Sanders.
Right. You know, I mean, think about how they look to us. They look at us and see the same distance.
So can we – I want to sort of transition into talking about what this means for the roundup of cases coming down the pike, right, or that are already in process. We brought you on a couple of months ago to give us a rundown. All of that was apparently for naught, right? So instead, we're going to have to start over and tell us, like, what is the fact that there are only eight justices and apparently, you know, per the conversation we've been having, we're not seeing that change anytime soon if Senate Republicans behave the way we expect them to. What is having eight justices mean for the rundown of cases?
So the ordinary rule is that if there's a 4-4 split, then whatever the lower court did is affirmed, and it's just as if the Supreme Court never took the case. So there's no precedential opinion from the Supreme Court. You just go with what the lower court said. There's a possibility that they could order some of these cases held over to the next term to be re-argued, theoretically, when a new justice is confirmed. That's a fairly common practice. But in the interim, whatever is the status quo is going to remain until a fifth vote comes along that can resolve that case.
And who makes the choice? How do they decide whether they're just going to behave as though they didn't grant cert in the first place, which is what you were describing, if there's a 4-4 split, versus when they're going to hold something over? How does that decision get made?
The justices themselves will make
it. Do they vote on it?
I mean, they probably vote on it, but like on that question, I suspect like they'll view it as a housekeeping matter, and like I think it's unlikely they will play games with like the question of how procedurally they're going to dispose of the cases. You know, they'll probably just decide as a housekeeping matter, like, does it look like someone's going to be confirmed? Does it make sense for us to hold these cases over, or should we just get rid of them and let the lower courts be in charge for a while? So, you know, in practice, for the cases that are in front of it, the big winner from having an 8-justice instead of a 9-justice Supreme Court is unions. There was a huge case that was threatening to defund public sector unions. It looked like there were 5 votes to buy into that theory. Now there's only 4, and that's not enough. And the lower court had rejected this attack on unions. So at least for now, the public sector unions are safe. The biggest loser, I told you white people can't get a break in this country. The biggest loser is white people.
Tell us why that is,
yeah,
Ian.
I'm referring specifically to this case called Evenwell, which was an attempt essentially to shift power in states where there is a large non-citizen immigrant population. It was an attempt to shift power from communities where there's non-citizen immigrants live to other communities, which would in practice shift House representation from Latino communities to whiter communities. And that's probably not going to happen.
I did not know about this case. I'm sorry. I'm just like, this sounds like
some, cover this one in our earlier
episode.
It
sounds like some like 3/5 compromise type.
It's seriously. It is a lot like the 3/5 compromise.
Yeah.
I hate to put it that starkly, but so.
Don't worry, Tracy did.
I did.
Okay,
that one's on her.
So what this case is about? The Constitution says that when House seats are allocated to a state, you count up the total number of people in that state,
right.
Regardless of whether they're a citizen, regardless of whether they've been disenfranchised, regardless of whether they're a child. Like you count up the number of people, and that's how you decide how many House districts a state gets. And then there's another principle called one person, one vote, which says when you carve the state up into congressional districts, each one of those districts has to have roughly the same number of people in it. What this lawsuit was trying to do is say that for purposes of deciding how many districts the state gets, you still have to use the total number of people. But for purposes of deciding how many people are in a district, you only count citizens. Mm-hmm. And what that – or you only count voters. And what that would mean is that in a state like Texas, where you have a lot of non-citizen Latinos, those non-citizens would still count to pad out Texas's House seats, so Texas would still get extra House seats. But then when the districts were divided up, they would be carved up in a way where the Latino communities would count for less, the other communities would account for more.
This is a lot of gymnastics.
It's a hugely complicated theory, but the idea is you have one rule for counting people.
Right.
For purposes of allocating representation, a totally different rule for purposes of districting. And the effect of it is that you shift power away from Latinos and towards white people.
Now, when you said that white people were the big losers, I thought you were going to bring us to the Fisher case.
Oh, no. White people are going to make out like gangbusters there.
Are they still post-Scalia?
Here's the bad news for affirmative action in Fisher, which is that Justice Kagan was already recused.
Justice Kagan's
an Obama appointee.
Right.
So what was going to be probably a 4-4 court anyway is now probably going to be a 4-3 court. And so you still have a majority for a conservative result. At oral argument, Kennedy seemed a little conflicted and like seemed to be eager to send it down to a lower court judge and basically let the lower court judge strike down the affirmative action policy here. I actually think that Scalia's death makes it more likely that Kennedy is going to cast a more conservative vote because he can send it down to a lower court judge and ask that lower court judge to do his dirty work for him when he knows that he controls a majority on the Supreme Court.
Right.
But now that it could be an Obama appointee casting that 5th vote, if Kennedy tries to put this off, it can make it up to the court again. And now we have a different majority.
Right. Well, yeah. We should probably clarify, though, that the big winner, if affirmative action is struck down, the big winner is mediocre white people.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
No, that's
right.
True. That's true. That's true. No offense to the appellant.
Right.
That maybe total
offense.
Right.
Yeah.
She's pretty mediocre.
Yeah.
She was decidedly mediocre.
Yeah.
That's the whole
thing. I think white women have benefited from affirmative action.
Right.
She was just too mediocre. So
that's
I mean, it's important to understand how affirmative action actually functions in unions. It's not like quotas have been unconstitutional since the 1980s. There is most people who get into any school that has an affirmative action plan are going to get in because it's just clear that they belong there and the school doesn't even consider their race. And then when you look at the marginal candidates, and like marginal candidates generally doesn't mean that they're like bad candidates. It means that like every single one of them would do fine here, but they're just not so superior that they automatically get in. Amongst the people who are qualified but not amongst the most elite, race can function sometimes as a tiebreaker.
Right.
You know, it can function as something that is one of many factors a school can consider when they're saying, well, we've only got three seats and we've got 10 people who want them, so, and they're all qualified.
Right.
So we got to pick someone.
Yeah.
And that's normally how it functions. The woman who's the plaintiff in this case wouldn't, I mean, her, she wasn't even at that level. She wouldn't have gotten in no matter, you know, no matter what system they
had. To paraphrase Chris Rock, you know, if there's a tie, F them, you got a 400-year head start. So
I think that just went up to shit just got real.
I know. I had to try and
you're
going to
have to step it up.
Yeah, you know, I mean, if you want me to step up my cursing game, I'm happy to do it. But like,
so then to move from affirmative action, there's also a key birth control case, right? Which, I mean, and I should say, like, there's a few cases on the docket here that have really timely implications,
right?
And could really set off all sorts of confusion among the circuits. The birth control case is one of them.
Yeah, I mean, this was going to be the term of the uterus. I mean,
I forgot you had said that.
There's a big birth control case. There's a big abortion case. The abortion case is the single biggest threat to Roe v. Wade, really in a generation since the Casey case in 1992. And so, because the rule is that in the absence of Supreme Court review, the lower courts are based, you know, their decisions stand, we're probably looking at a situation where a woman's right to reproductive freedom is going to vary based on what state they are in. So in the birth control case,
because it'll come down to what a circuit has held.
Exactly, like what the circuit that is jurisdiction over their state, what that circuit has held. So if you know in the birth control case, Zubik, the issue is whether or not a woman's boss gets to decide, because they have a religious objection to it, that woman doesn't get to have a birth control health plan. Doesn't get to have a health plan that covers birth control. Almost every circuit has said that no, a woman's boss doesn't get to make that decision for them. But the Eighth Circuit, which is Iowa and Arkansas and Minnesota and Nebraska and I think one other state, has said that a woman's boss does get to make that decision. So this is the only time that this will ever be said about Mississippi. But what that means is that if you are a woman living in Mississippi, you have more rights with respect to birth control than if you're a woman living in Arkansas right now. And so long as there's a 4-4 court,
it's geographic lotto.
Yeah.
Jesus. That's terrifying. And I think the last time you were on, we were talking about, I mean, it's so clear how politically motivated these sorts of things are at the state level, because oftentimes state senators will say, well, they can go to another state and get an abortion or get birth control or whatever the case might be. It's like, well, then you're clearly not concerned about the health or the safety of the system if you're willing to have them be someone else's problem.
Well, the line has to become, well, they could just go to another circuit.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, exactly.
Although, let's be clear about what's going on there. I mean, Texas can only do Texas. Like, I'm sure that if the Texas legislature had the power to pass a law saying, oh, and by the way, New Mexico, you're not allowed to have abortion clinics
they'd
either.
They do that too.
They'd happily do it. Like, you know,
Don't give them any ideas.
Yeah. Like, you know, the one good thing I could say about the Texas legislature is that it can only pass laws that affect Texas.
So another interesting case, and I just love how this is phrased. It's in your article that has a roundup on these, so everyone could go on thinkprogress.org and look at a piece Ian recently wrote.
We're being so promotional.
I know.
Today.
Yeah. The Simply
By the way, my book is called Injustices, available at all major booksellers.
But once you're on the Ian Millhiser roundup, you can go check out The Simply Breathtaking Consequences of Justice Scalia's Death, which goes through all of these cases. But the last one that you have is called The Fate of the Earth. So that is a very heavy claim. Can you talk about this?
And before you answer, can I just nerdily say, so when I was reading your piece and I saw that you titled this The Fate of the Earth, I just couldn't help but think, like, oh my God, this is real life, the Pelican Brief. Like, I mean, yes, we would need to lose one more justice to truly be there, right? But like, am I the only one who thought about that?
No, I mean, there's, you know, shit did get real.
Yeah. Of course, Scalia, to be clear, was not assassinated, and certainly not by the White House. So I'm not trying to confuse the fact. I'm getting all these faces. You guys haven't seen the Pelican Brief recently?
No, I'm,
I've certainly seen Twitter. There's all these theories involving
a pillow.
I
did see a lot of theories. He died of natural causes.
Right.
We'll just make we're not truthers or anything.
I was
lost in our giggling.
I was going Grisham there. We'll move past the Grisham and back to the real life facts. But that was hard to ignore when you talked about the environmental consequences.
Yeah. So the clean power plan is the most significant thing that Obama has done to fight climate change. It will reduce the United States' total emissions, all of them, by 16% by 2030. Which is a lot. It's expected to save thousands of lives. This is a really big deal. And Scalia, one of his final acts on Earth may have been to doom the Earth, because he briefly suspended. He cast the fifth vote to block those rules. Now, it's a temporary block that lasts until the lower court decides whether these rules are legal, and then the Supreme Court decides whether or not they want to take the case. So it doesn't last forever. But for the time being, those rules aren't in effect. And if those rules are ultimately struck down, which will hinge upon what the lower court does, whether we still have a 4-4 court, and who gets confirmed to fill the seat, it doesn't just mean that those rules aren't in effect. First of all, it raises a serious cloud of doubt as to whether or not the federal government has the ability to fight climate change. And second of all, if you are any other country that is being asked to make concessions in order to fight climate change, and you look at the Supreme Court of the United States saying that we're not going to do our part, they aren't going to do their part either. You know, this goes to our question about whether we have credibility on the international stage to make the promises we made in Paris, and, you know, to make any promise really whatsoever to another nation. And so it's very frightening.
I was about to say, with everything that happened in Paris, it looks like this will have a ripple effect.
Right.
So this really is the fate of the Earth.
Right.
This is terrifying. But
yeah. And I mean, when you talk about like the downstream consequences of climate change, you're literally talking about like Miami being swallowed up by the ocean. You're talking about the southwest part of the United States becoming a dust bowl. You're talking about a refugee crisis. I mean, there has not been a threat to humanity like this since the book of Genesis. I like that.
But oh, I mean, I don't like that. I like,
right.
I like the phrasing of that. I'm going to use that. But in the final few minutes that we have with you, we want to, you know, start speculating about who could possibly be nominated to fill Scalia's seat, but also to try and convince Republicans in the Senate that, you know, maybe they do actually want to vote. It sounds like a couple senators have been on record saying maybe they will consider a nominee. But who do you think are the most likely choices for Obama?
I mean, there's such a huge list of names. I doubt your listeners want to hear me rattle off 20 names. But, like, I think there's basically three models. So the first model is the olive branch. And the name that's commonly being thrown out as a possible olive branch is Sri Srinivasan on the D.C. Circuit. Sri was confirmed 97-0. Brilliant, but has a very moderate record. Clerk for Justice O'Connor, who was a Reagan appointee. And so under normal circumstances, if someone like Sri were nominated, that would be a Democratic president's way of saying to Republicans, I'm going to meet you halfway so that we don't have a fight. He's probably still going to get a fight anyways. The second approach would be a more conventional Democratic nominee. The name that's being thrown a lot to represent this option is Paul Watford. Judge Watford's on the Ninth Circuit, African-American judge, clerk for Justice Ginsburg. And, you know, his record suggests that he's a fairly standard, I mean, very, very intelligent, but what you would mainline Democratic appointee in the mold of a Sotomayor or a Kagan. And then the third option is he could go to war. And if he wanted to go to war, the person I'd really love to see him pick is Nina Pillard on the D.C. Circuit. Judge Pillard isn't just like the only person that I can think of offhand who is openly pro-choice that he might nominate. But she even has an article where she speaks about a right to female sexual pleasure. So,
this lady.
Yeah.
We should get her on the show.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I would love for a confirmation fight where the Republicans get tricked into turning this into a referendum on the female orgasm. I don't know that that's the route that the White House is going to go.
Do you think they're familiar with the fact that it exists?
Probably not.
Because, I mean, to go to war with something, you have to sort of concede it's... Anyway.
Boom.
Probably a reason they're so cranky.
But I think we're talking about their wives, right? Aren't we?
Well, yeah, that's where we're going.
Let's be clear. There's a reason why they're not getting any.
So, Ian Millhiser, justice editor at Think Progress, and our sort of justice correspondent, as it were. Thank you for being here. Thank you for always making SCOTUS fun.
And we'll have you back soon as more things develop around this.
As it turns out, a lot is happening.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope we don't lose another justice, but if we do, you'll be back with us for the real-life Pelican Brief.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and also the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. And with me in studio for a special Nerd Heaven segment that I've been looking forward to for a long time, Alex Lawson. He's the Executive Director of Social Security Works. He is also sort of my boss, although he disagrees with that because he owns WEACT Radio. He's shaking his head at me. He doesn't agree that he is my boss. He's going to say that I'm his boss, but that's okay. Why do I even have you here? I could just do your side of the conversation. He's also a friend of the show. Thank you for coming back, Alex. And we also have with us Ezra Levin. He's the Associate Director of Government Affairs at the Corporation for Enterprise Development. I got that right.
Nailed it. Absolutely nailed
it. I got it right. Thank you. And becoming a fast friend of the show, had you on a couple of weeks ago.
We'll see how today goes.
That's right. It's always a test whether we're going to ask you back. But I'm really excited to have both of you on. Particularly after President's Day, right? A lot of discussion of our great presidents over the years, but sort of, you know, perhaps comparatively little discussion of the founding fathers, which has special importance for Talk Poverty and for discussions of poverty and anti-poverty programs. So, you know, I want to start with you, Ezra. Tell us, I mean, why are the founding fathers important in a conversation about poverty? What am I hinting at here?
Well, so, I mean, I think the reason why the founding fathers are important in our work is because we can look to them for inspiration and for the roots of a lot of the policies that we're advocating for today. So when you hear folks like Elizabeth Warren say that, you know, great if you started a factory, but you're really relying on society to help you bring your goods to market, or you hear Barack Obama say you didn't build that, they're not making up these phrases. This is rooted in philosophy that's hundreds of years old, and it's not just the underpinnings, the philosophical underpinnings. It's actually the precise policies, which we'll get to today. Actual, basically, policy papers coming out a couple hundred years ago are the basis for some of the ideas we're fighting about right now. So it's super relevant to today's debate.
And Alex Lawson, to put you on the spot, do you have a favorite founding father? You seem like someone who would have a favorite founding father.
I do. I actually have a whole range of them. You know, I put them in order, but my favorite is Lafayette. And you know, he's a character that's oftentimes forgotten in history, but he was as famous as George Washington at the time, and he saved America and George Washington from defeat with a very timely sailing over with some French boats. and then kind of connected there because at the time there was a focus on America and our experiment here, but there was a movement that was actually much more global, and that's why Lafayette was actually connected with America, and that's why another of my favorite founding fathers, Thomas Paine, actually is also, he's very much rooted in the history and woven into the fabric of America's creation, but the ideas that they were talking about, the ideas that are woven into our founding documents are actually, it's a rich history, a philosophical history that was pretty global at the time and was transforming the entire world. And I think that that's something that, I don't know if we've disconnected from that today, but the understanding that these ideas that we were at the forefront of, but they were transforming countries around the world. And I am being a little oblique, but like Thomas Paine, speaking directly to the people, had a lot of ideas that, you know, when I say Social Security is as American as apple pie, it's because I'm referencing the fact that the first proposal for a social insurance program was written by Thomas Paine in 1797. And that is, you know, something that I don't think a lot of people realize, that our ideas are actually woven into the fabric of America. Actually, America was almost created because of the ideas that we fight for. It was against this inherited, propertied, moneyed power structure that was just completely unequal, and there was no way that it could change. That was what a lot of the revolution was against.
Well, so let's get into who Thomas Paine is, right? Because just to show our hand, the three of us have been talking for a while about actually doing a segment digging into Paine and in particular to one of his pamphlets that, as you have noted, Alex, was the first effectively white paper calling for Social Security. So, I mean, Ezra, I want to bring you in. Who was Thomas Paine?
Paine's a great guy. It's just fun to read Paine, too, because he gets so angry in his writings. He really just jazzes up these ideas. You think it's going to be a really boring philosophical treatise. That's not what it is. You go read some Paine. It's pretty short. It gets to the point. It really will get your blood boiling. But Paine is great. He is not an elite. He is the son of a corset maker. He trains to be a corset maker in England. And he goes, he's a privateer for a year, comes back, has a few dollars, becomes a public employee, meets Benjamin Franklin while lobbying for the public employees, and ends up going to America with the help of Ben Franklin, and becomes a public intellectual, really one of the earliest public intellectuals. And I think the great thing about Paine, well, many great things about Paine, I think we'll get to agrarian justice and some of the awesome ideas in there, but one of the great things about Paine is it's not just that he's creating these new ideas in his works. That's part of it, but when the revolution is kicking off, 1776, early on, he publishes Common Sense anonymously. And the great thing about Common Sense is that it's written for the people. It's really this document that's supposed to go and get folks excited about revolution, recast the debate about revolution. So when,
and this is the pamphlet that is described as having sort of paved the way for the Declaration of Independence.
That's right. So and it's a document that is read. It's read to the soldiers. It's read to the citizens. It's read to really galvanize support for this effort, which doesn't look too good in 1776. Right. It looks kind of like we're going to lose.
It looks even more than a little like we're going to lose. Yeah. Actually, we're continually losing.
That's right?
Right. George Washington is continually losing to the British.
Morale was low.
But I really do think you pointing out that it was by George Washington's order that Paine's words were read to the soldiers because he was speaking to people about why this cause, which was a cause for humanity, that is what they were fighting for. And it inspired people. And then you have Lafayette sail across the ocean as well, which is very helpful.
Also very important.
But
bringing him back in there, very subtle.
I just to be not subtle about it, that these ideas were not just American, that America was actually, even in its birth, was pulling from Lafayette's French. Thomas Paine was not born in America, but these are key characters in the creation of America because What it was this idea. It was this beautiful idea that people were fighting for, that people should have the ability to succeed based on their own merits, not based on their blood or where they were born, right? All of those concepts. And obviously, it wasn't perfect in its creation. And as time goes on, we're better as we go towards a more perfect union. But those ideas really are woven in, even all the way at the start of America.
That internationalism, great. I think it points to another great thing about Paine. There's a story about him and Ben Franklin. Ben Franklin says, where there is justice, that is my country. Who knows if the story is right? Supposedly Paine pipes up, no, where there is injustice, that is my country. So you see Paine fighting for revolutionary, egalitarian ideals in in England, in America, in France. So he's just such a freaking inspiring figure. Incredibly impressive. Let's get to some of his revolutionary ideas.
Before we do, I wanted to go back to something that that was really interesting that I want it to get its due. And yeah. You noted, Ezra, that the way that he wrote was different than the style at the time. How was it different?
He's writing to the people. So, I mean, he is simply not writing to elites. He's not so what would be the difference? I think the difference is perhaps if you think Piketty today, he blew up. His book comes out and everybody's talking about, but in a relatively small circle here, or maybe a lot of people buy Piketty's book and put it on the shelf and say that they read it. This is a different level. This is Harry Potter level. This is this is writing that really speaks to everybody, and it's incredibly accessible. And because of that accessibility, his ideas are able to catch fire. I think it's appropriate that we're talking about this in Talk Poverty. There's really a similar goal between Paine and what we're trying to do here, which is not just speak to the inside the Beltway crowd about ideas, but highlight the voices of the people and speak to them too.
And just because I have to, also like Harry Potter, deeply progressive, and in this incredibly accessible way so that people can understand these archetypal narratives that you see throughout Harry Potter as incredibly progressive. There's so much work on equality woven into these stories, but it's not written in a hectoring or lecturing way, but in a way that is inspiring to people because these ideas connect. And I did get a degree in philosophy, so I do sometimes wander out into that area.
But to make sure you're putting it to good use.
Yes, exactly. but that is what I think is, I actually believe that ideas like this can be beautiful unto themselves, and they connect with people. And like I said, the fact that George Washington actually ordered Thomas Paine's words to be read because he captured the idea that people were willing to fight for. And again, Lafayette sailed his boats across them. So you have that's important too.
So without further ado, I want to take a trip to platform 9 3/4,
sure.
Right? If we can. Agrarian justice. Ezra, you mentioned it, and Alex, I want you to actually give an overview of it because your organization, Social Security Works, actually has published its own edition of Agrarian Justice, so I would expect you know a little something about it.
So let me actually tell you why we published, because I think all of us can dig into the details, but why we published it is what I mentioned it earlier. Oftentimes, I'm arguing with opponents of Social Security, greedy. They're paid liars by greedy liars on Wall Street. They pay them, and then they come on and they sow discord and confusion. And one of their main tactics is to try to tell this story that Social Security and these ideas of us working together and creating things that we can't do on our own are somehow alien or foreign to America, when in fact the exact opposite is true. This BS Wall Street greed over everything, I'm going to get all of mine and leave everyone else behind, that is un-American. Actually, the ideas of us working together, of the people working together and being able to create something that's just so much more than we could create individually. That's why we published the first proposal for a social insurance system,
which is agrarian justice,
1797. And it's so that I can say Social Security is as American as apple pie. And apple pie is brought to America by the Dutch.
I was going to say, when do you
date apple pie to.
It's exactly. Probably, yeah. But it's actually, I mean, not to be too profound about my metaphors, but that the ideas that are brought to America from whatever place, it's actually the concept that is key. That's what makes America America, the ideals of America, the vision of always getting better and better and better. And that is why Agrarian Justice, published in 1797, it's actually more forward thinking than what we have now. It is a near universal old age and disability pension system that he envisions. But it also has this other aspect, which is a cash payment to people when they hit majority, which we have not yet gotten there. I would like us to get
there. Which is like the children's savings accounts that we had you on a couple weeks to talk about.
I think the context for when it was published and what it was responding to is super interesting, too. There is this terrible sermon that's titled "The Wisdom and Goodness of God in Having Made Both Rich and Poor." And this just really makes Thomas Paine mad because what he thinks is God didn't create the poor and the rich. That's ridiculous. God created people and gave them the earth to inherit. So this idea that is actually really popular at the time, that actually there are folks who were born to be poor, there are folks who are born to be rich, and that poverty serves a purpose, he hated it. And so he's fighting against that idea in Agrarian Justice.
And he has a quote that seems like it's directly responsive to that line from that sermon. He says in Agrarian Justice, "The rugged face of society, checkered with the extremes of affluence and want, proves that some extraordinary violence has been committed upon it and calls on justice for redress." Right? Said it better than I could have, I think.
That's right. And I think one of those last words that you had was really crucial, justice. And this gets to this whole concept in the policies that he's proposing here. It's all about justice. And so what he's trying to get at is that when we talk about providing support to the poor, this isn't welfare. This isn't charity. This isn't something we're doing out of the goodness of our hearts. This is something that is necessary to do to actually serve justice, because the poor have been disinherited from their natural inheritance, which is the earth. They have found this condition of poverty as a result of society, which has forced them, maybe through bad jobs or through wage theft or through generations of inheritances that they didn't get. So he's all about serving justice with these policies, and really doesn't look too kindly on the idea of charity or the idea of welfare.
And justice, which is in the title, Agrarian Justice, that piece of it might be intuitive. It makes sense to someone who hasn't read it. But Alex, what's the agrarian connection?
I don't think there's as straightforward an agrarian connection. I mean, there is. I don't have a really good answer for that one. I actually think something. I mean, like, some of his ideas are when you start people with money. I mean, I don't know.
Is it because of the land thing, though?
So this is how I read it. I could be wrong. Yeah. The way I read it is that the reason why it's agrarian justice is because he's responding to this comment that God created rich and poor, but in fact, no, God created man and woman and gave them the earth to inherit.
So it's the earth piece.
Everybody, as a human being, has a right to the earth. Society then takes it away and distributes this property in different ways. And so it's about getting back to that fundamentally just distribution of natural inheritance.
Because the piece at it, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Alex, I want to get you back in, but just to make sure I'm understanding, the piece is sort of at its core about property ownership, right? And mm-hmm. and what is property ownership? What is the concept of ownership? And what is the proper redistribution? And why might we need redistribution, right?
So it's great because it's actually about two kinds of property. And so he draws a distinction between these two kinds of property. One is your natural property that you inherit. It's the earth, it's the air, it's the sky. That's what everybody gets. And then there's this other kind of property, which is man-made. It's wealth that's accumulated over time. And so when he's talking about justice, he considers both of these. And he starts out immediately and says, look, you know, there's nothing we can do about, or there's not much we can do about man-created property. People are going to put in extra work. They're going to earn. We're not looking for a quality of that kind of property. What we're looking for is a quality of that inheritance, which really is the difference between a quality of outcome and the equality of opportunity. And this is about the equality of opportunity.
Mm-hmm. The reason I like hesitate to answer that is because I have long thought that he should have named it something else, like societal justice.
Right.
Because
Or social justice.
Or social justice. And I think it's almost a proto idea of social justice, because there's a huge discussion, and I want to point out that while he's at these big topics, he also is in deep in the economics of why this all makes perfect sense as well. He spends a lot of time detailing how there can be no wealth without society, how a person cannot be rich if they are the only person in a wild area, right? That it is only through society that somebody can have wealth or not have wealth. And so even the richest people owe that ability to be rich to a society, that they cannot actually be rich on their own.
Which is what gets us to how inequality and poverty, these are man-made outcomes. These are inventions of society and of civilization. But I want to dig into something that you just brought up, Alex, which is the concept of some people, and when he is discussing this class of people, he's describing them as landowners, that they have a debt to society that they need to repay. And this isn't just an observation. This is really at the core of what he then proposes as policy to achieve the justice that he is calling for. What does he call for? What is his policy? And there's a revenue component, but there's also a sort of a social insurance component.
So I think it's easiest to put it to like literally update it to our times and talk about, he's talking about the billionaire class. He's talking about people who are the 1%, the tippy top, is the 1,000th of the top 1%, who own so much of the wealth at that time. And he's saying that accumulation, they didn't do that on their own. And so actually there is a need that to bring that inequality down. And he proposes what I still believe is a very fair way of doing it. He proposes a near universal social insurance system, so an old age pension and a disability pension. And I'll leave you to speak to the also just cash payment when a person hits majority, which is so that they don't start in debt, but they start with an asset. And he says they could buy a cow, and then they could be productive members of society and
the
economy.
That's what I did when I turned 21.
Yes.
Yeah. You spent it on a cow.
A cow.
Obviously.
I clearly haven't been to your house recently enough, Ezra.
But the part that that I think is just a brilliant idea, and the concept of this insurance that everyone gets it and they own it. But the way he pays for it, I think, is really critical for understanding his view on this as well, because he pays for it with an estate tax. So he pays for it and he spends a lot of time, and I fully agree with him, detailing why this is absolutely the most fair way to deal with it, because he's not even taxing the 1% or the billionaire class. He's saying, I'm not going to tax you. I'm going to tax the estate that is left behind when you die, which literally cannot even exist if there is not a society to protect that estate. And at that point, we can take a tax on that estate and we can funnel it. We can use it to pay for this near universal program that people earn that protects them against lost wages. And that has this wonderful effect of lowering inequality. And that's literally as true today as it was in 1797. If we actually took the estate tax and dedicated it to Social Security, a legacy tax to pay for a legacy debt, as we are like to say, that is a very, very good way of actually making Social Security even more progressive than it is, because you get this revenue coming in only on estates, not on people.
And I actually liked in the introduction to the version of Agrarian Justice that y'all published, you draw a direct connection between this estate tax and the principles at the founding of the country. You say the War of Independence was sought to rid America of royalty, aristocracy, exactly, and entitled nobility. Inherited wealth is at odds with the idea of a meritocracy. I think this is one of the reasons why he goes to the estate tax,
exactly,
for that exact reason.
And I think, and again, it's as true today as it was then. This massive imbalance of wealth, the inequality leads to chaos. It leads to instability, and it leads to there has to be a change. And the way you can do it is by you just first have to vocalize that it is a problem when the few have so much and the many have so little, and it's un-American, and it's actually almost not commensurate with America.
And Ezra, I want to bring you in to summarize the sort of 1700s version of the children's savings accounts as well, because
right.
I know we don't, I wish we had all day to talk about this, but I'm being told our time is short.
Oh, no. Okay. We'll just keep on talking once the mics go off.
That's right.
Okay, great.
There will be a special bonus web version for
excellent.
The truly dedicated.
Okay, so there's the other big idea in agrarian justice is this idea that once you turn age 21, you ought to have a little bit of money to start off life with. Maybe you buy a cow or you could buy a house. You start a business, pay for your education. And he proposes that age 21, every single American would get 15 pounds, which doesn't sound like a whole bunch of money, but it's around 3 months' salary, median income at the time. If you actually adjust for inflation, it's around $3,000 today, but it's even more than that in terms of the income folks have. And the basic idea here is that it comes back to this idea of justice. It's being funded through the estate tax. So it's taking the excess wealth, the excess opportunity that folks have had in society, taking a piece of that and investing seeing in the opportunity of the next generation. So there's definitely a great amount of poetic justice in that structure. And the basic idea is opportunity policy. As Alex mentioned earlier, it's about trying to prevent poverty before it starts by giving people a head start.
And in the minute and a half or so that we have, I sort of want to go back to what this means for the current political conversation, right? I was struck, Alex, you mentioned, sort of that we're hearing a lot of discussion, right, about the inequality, the levels that it's reached. There's a lot of anger there. This is, timely given a lot of what we're hearing in the presidential cycle. But I'm sort of just struck by the reality on the ground, right, that for example, as we talk about the estate tax, which is often called the death tax, there's, zero political possibility, right, with that, given, where one party is. But more to sort of the point in terms of an ongoing political debate, the step-up basis in capital gains, right? I mean, there's more spending on that in a year than there is on the entire child tax credit. Right. That, I mean, you can do a side by side. And that's the large, our largest expenditure on our nation's children. Right.
So the angel of death tax cut.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So an optimism engendering conversation that we're having, and nice to remember sort of our roots. How can we sort of inject, as my last question to both of you, sort of for the lightning round, how can we bring this back, this notion that these aren't new ideas, that these aren't ideas that we've, taken from other countries in a way that is foreign to us? How do we bring this back as core to American values?
I tell you, first, we just keep talking about it like we are right now. But I will tell you that I'm way more optimistic than many people because, yes, right now it doesn't seem like things can happen. But that's what the greedy liars on Wall Street, they spend an enormous amount of money to make it seem like it's impossible. But just remembering that this inequality has struck a nerve because people recognize it as un-American. It's like hitting America's funny bone. And once America's like, wait a minute, why are those greedy liars on Wall Street hoovering up all the wealth in this country and I'm paying the bill? No. We are the people and we demand justice. And then once that demand is clarion and clear, it moves very quickly, and those greedy liars on Wall Street will be quite shocked how fast that justice can come.
And Ezra, you'll have the last word.
Great.
Tell you how you like it.
So I disagree with everything Alex just said. No. So I don't think things are any there's no reason to be less optimistic now than Payne was that America could succeed and secede and start a new country. Things looked pretty bad back then. As Alex said, there are a lot of reasons to be optimistic today. I think there are two ways that we make policy. One is in these big changes where we get brand new programs, and that's great, and we should fight for those. There are also small steps in the right direction that we can take, common sense ways that we can get everybody on board so they can look at a policy proposal and say,
say, well, obviously that's a good idea. One thing that we talked about in the last podcast is preventing low-income families from saving for their kids' education, penalizing them for saving for their kids' education. That's crazy. Nobody wants to do that. There's a bipartisan bill to prevent that from happening. So I think keeping the conversation alive in both the big ways and the small ways is important.
Well, thank you both for nerding out with me. We actually managed to avoid pain puns. I can't believe we were that good. Alex Lawson, Executive Director of Social Security Works and so much more, and Ezra Levin from the Corporation for Enterprise Development. Thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the We Act Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.